Monster Man, Episode 121, Poltergeist to Protein Polymorph. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are completing our journey through the P chapter of the Fiend Folio, the 1981 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and we're going to look at the last two monsters in that section. Now, as you can hear, I'm still a bit croaky, still got a bit of a sore throat, so I apologize. I may be taking a little bit easy on this one, but hopefully we should be back to normal shortly. Without further ado, let's look at these monsters. The first on our list is the Poltergeist. The Poltergeist was adapted for Dungeons & Dragons, I don't want to say created, by Lou Pulsifer, a significant name in the history of early D&D, particularly in Britain, where he's sort of one of the game's leading exponents. Now, the poltergeist is a very interesting kind of undead. I don't need to tell you what a poltergeist is, I'm sure, but I'll just quickly recap. Poltergeist comes from German words that mean noisy spirit, and a poltergeist is the kind of ghost that doesn't have a physical or even a kind of visual appearance, but manifests itself by moving stuff around, you know, pictures moving on shelves, books flying through the air, furniture being turned over, rapping noises, all that kind of thing. That's a poltergeist. And I do think that the word was in fairly common usage, but it was about to get a big boost because the Fiend Folio comes out in 1981, and then in 1982, the film Poltergeist comes out. So actually, maybe the word wasn't as widespread in 1981 as it would subsequently be, although it was already well known, particularly if you were the kind of person that studied the paranormal. And I think that's really the interesting thing about the poltergeist in terms of its background, is that creatures in Dungeons & Dragons tend to be rooted sort of in mythology or in fantasy fiction. There are only a handful, well, or in, you know, real life, like the lions are real or whatever. There are only a handful of monsters that fall into the kind of cryptid category, and in many cases, those are substantially altered. For example, in the Monster Manual and the Fiend Folio, there's no Sasquatch. Right. There is a Yeti, at least I think there's no Sasquatch. There is a Yeti, but it's very different from what people who believe in Yetis think a Yeti is actually like, right? Because the truth is that most cryptids, that is to say most, it is an animal as yet unknown, like, you know, Loch Ness Monster or, you know, the Lee County Lizard Man or whatever, where it is believed that this creature is a natural phenomenon of some kind that has just eluded science. They're not that interesting other than the fact that they exist, right? The shocking thing about Sasquatch would be that Sasquatch existed. But that's the story. Right? There's nothing to it other than there's a species of hominids that we don't know about. That would be shocking and amazing enough by itself. But in the world of Dungeons & Dragons, a world where monsters are real and magic is real, that's not a big deal. So the Yeti has to be a mountain threat. Because the role that the Yeti would play as a mountain threat in a more naturalistic story is already taken up by any other number of monsters. But I guess what I mean is that that's not really true of the poltergeist. Well, the poltergeist in D&D has its lethality upped a little bit, right? You know, that the fighters are crouching behind their shields while this thing chucks bricks or whatever. But that's not out of line with what people expect from a poltergeist. Just that in modern-day paranormal belief, people tend not to think of poltergeists typically as, you know, lethally dangerous. But this does what you'd expect a ghost to do. It moves things around, and it fills victims with a sense of fear, and they run away. It's interesting that it haunts the spot where it died, so there you get some kind of narrative hook, like the poltergeist might be a clue that something happened there. The very fact that the spot is haunted might indicate the danger that killed the person, or might lead you to where their remains are, which would allow you to get some kind of, you know, clue or treasure from them. So I think the poltergeist is a narratively interesting monster, and it's particularly good because ghosts, we have to walk a very fine line with ghosts, because ghosts are, as I've said in the several episodes that we've had about ghosts, including the My Favorite Monster special with Hannah Powell Smith, ghosts are very narrative monsters. But you have to be cautious about how they communicate, because the last thing you want to do is normalize them, right? You don't want to go, well, you can achieve a certain aesthetic effect by doing it, but in general, you don't want a ghost to pop up and go, hi, I'm Sharon, I'm dead. I've been being dead for about 300-400 years. My other interests include trying to get vengeance for my unlawful slaying. You take the mystery and spookiness out of them, and we're already working hard to try and maintain one category of monsters being mysterious and spooky in a world where monsters are everywhere. So I think poltergeists kind of neatly solve that problem. They're clearly trying to tell you something. Get out, mostly. But they have such a limited set of tools available to do it that actually maintains that edge of mystery no matter how hard you try to normalize them. I guess I kind of got distracted from my main point earlier about cryptids and stuff. What I mean about poltergeists is that it's just interesting. Poltergeists are one of the few creatures in the Monster Manual that people really believe in. People who believe in poltergeists don't necessarily believe in, like, banshees. And so this is a relatively small category of, you know, there's a lot of people out there who think that the poltergeist is a real thing, which is not true for a lot of the creatures in the Monster Manual. And it's interesting to see how well this essentially modern belief, because older ghost stories are very like, hi, I'm Sharon, I'm a ghost, don't take land from the monastery. And it's essentially, you know, post-medieval belief fits really well into the sort of medieval classical structure of most D&D monsters. Anyway, as a poltergeist, it's pretty good. Now we have a real odd one designed by Tom Moldvay. This is the protein polymorph. A protein polymorph is basically a really buff mimic. That's wrong, but what I mean is that it is a protoplasmic shape-changing organism that can turn itself into anything, unlike the mimic, which can only mimic, as it were, like stone and wood and other, you know, inanimate objects. The protein polymorph can duplicate a living being, although it'll betray itself. You know, it's not perfect. There's a chance to notice it, and it can't impersonate them. It can just look like them, so it can't speak. Although, it is smart. I mean, it's about as intelligent as a typical human. The protein polymorph puts me in mind of the thing from another world. Well, not the thing from another world in the sense of the James R. Ness movie, but the thing as it appears in the John Carpenter film, The Thing, and the story, Who Goes There, that it's based on. Now, here's an interesting coincidence. The John Carpenter movie, The Thing, came out the same year as Poltergeist. That is 1982. So, this is not based on the film version, but the Carpenter film is much closer to the Campbell story in terms of creature can do. So I wonder if that's an inspiration. That would also help explain the fact that the protein polymorph has a particularly science fiction sounding name, and one that fits rather awkwardly with the general naming conventions of Dungeons and Dragons. And in that respect, it reminds me of another monster we've already talked about on the show, the Seafall, which also has that, like, the, you know, colony insect formed artificial life, which really does not sound like something that people in a fantasy setting would call it. And that's an aesthetic decision, and certainly I think you're very unlikely to hear somebody in your D&D game call this thing a protein polymorph. Indeed, my understanding is, and I have not looked into this in too much detail, that the protein polymorph is very similar to a creature that appears in a later basic, or B/X, Dungeons & Dragons scenario. That creature is called the Polymar. And that's also by Tom Moldvay, so maybe he slightly modified it for its appearance there. I was initially convinced that this was a scenario monster, but it doesn't seem to be. Just because a lot of the things that are introduced by, that are credited to American writers in the Fiend Folio are places where something has been moved in from an existing scenario, like the Drow. But this appears to be a new creature, like the Bullywugs. And the protein polymorph is pretty good. You can definitely imagine this thing being like the king of the mimics, or being like the evolved final state of the mimic, right? Like, imagine that that there are, we know that there are mimics, and then there are super mimics, and the super mimics are kind of mindlessly aggressive. But you know, what if they also began to evolve into this more advanced, more adaptable state that could turn into more things? Of course, mimics can talk, which this thing can. I do think that this type of monster poses a challenge in terms of presenting it because, you know, in films, which is where a lot of these stories are taken from, or in comic books or on television, you know, in visual media, it's a lot easier to do the which one is the real one and which is the imposter story. Because around a gaming table, it is almost always impossible to do that story without the players. The players have to play along, basically, right? They have to, they won't be fooled out of character, but it's very easy to tell who's a player and who's an NPC. One of them's being played by the DM. So, you know, the players can, like, act out the role of their characters being astonished by not knowing which one is which, but in fact, they will know which one is which. And there's very few ways to solve that. I have done it in tabletop games. At one point, I had a character in a game I was running who had hallucinations, and I got all the other players to play along and, like, act out the situation that was developing in that character's hallucination. And, you know, we played it out as if it were the thing, and then I said, okay, and, you know, you wake up. And that, I mean, on the one hand, that's a very effective, like, it's a stunt. You know what I mean? Like, it's effective and it's cool, but it's a gimmick. And you can only do it once. You only have to do it once to kind of say, hey, look, your perceptions of reality aren't reliable. But it's also kind of a railroad, right? Things had to go a certain way in order for it to be effective. You can get the cooperation of the player, but I feel like... So that's one way that you could do it. Like, if you get the cooperation of the player being impersonated... You could definitely, you know, just say, like, okay, Shirley, like, what does Zenobia A do? Now, what does Zenobia B do? You know, if they were willing to play along, that could be a lot of fun. But again, I don't know that you could do it more than once. On the other hand, I say that about a lot of monsters in this book, and I don't know that you need to do it more than once. I mean, let's be 100% real here. Are you going to have a protein polymorph turn up more than once in your campaign? You're probably not. Not unless the dungeon itself is some kind of lab where these things are being grown in tanks, and they're all over the place, and they've kind of, like, turned into imitations of the scientists that created them, but actually... You know, they're just going through the motions, trying to desperately replicate the experiments that allowed them to make more of their kind. It's actually a pretty fun scenario. But even then, you're only going to do it once. You're just going to have a lot of them. Though they're pretty buff, so I don't know if having a lot of them is necessarily the right choice. One thing that the protein polymorph suffers from, that the poltergeist has this as well, but it's not a problem because poltergeists actually are invisible, but that there's no illustration for the protein polymorph, something that it shares with another Moldvay monster from the Fiend Folio, the Astral Searcher. And there is actually, like, so Jeff D, who was an artist on a lot of early TSR products, and also did some comics work, unless I'm not mistaken. But anyway, I mostly associate him with the RPG Villains and Vigilantes, but he did a lot of other stuff as well. He has a protein polymorph illustration up on his DeviantArt page. If you go to Jeff D's DeviantArt, you'll see drawings of monsters that he wanted to do for the Fiend Folio, I guess, but they didn't get in there. I don't think these are the original... I don't think these are drawings he did from the 80s. They look a bit more modern than that. So I think he sort of is... they were intended to be in there, but then time ran out or whatever, or, you know, the legal problems or something got in the way. And so he's just kind of, like, drawing them and putting them up on the internet to show what he thinks they would have looked like. And that's really cool. I think this is a creature that if you can link it to a compelling visual image, obviously when it's not impersonating someone, then I think that's really great. Otherwise, I think it suffers a wee bit because it, you know, say what you like, even about a shape-changing creature, like, mimics have a really distinctive visual image, despite the fact that the whole point of a mimic is you can't tell it apart from anything else. And I think if the protein polymorph had something like that, it would be a lot better. I mean, it just occurred to me that protein polymorph is another kind of implementation of the Shoggoth idea, right? Shoggoths are adaptable and they can be anything, but it lacks the backstory that makes the Shoggoth really horrific. Anyway, I think they're actually pretty versatile, and it wouldn't take much to make a protein polymorph a really fun part of your D&D game. All right, that's it for P. In the next chapter, we're going to go take a look at Q, and that's going to mean talking about the Quaggoth, the Quipper, and the Cullen on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.